This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. David Horsey, the editorial cartoonist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, won his first Pulitzer Prize in 1999 for the way he treated such topics as the Monica Lewinsky scandal, the Republican attack on Bill Clinton, and a scandal involving Washington State's child protection services. He just won his second Pulitzer, a rarity, for cartoons covering such topics as the Middle East, the economy, proposed tax cuts, homeland security, and the build-up to the war on Iraq. Horsey definitely is a cartoonist with an edge. Sometimes he dispenses with humor altogether and merely records his take on current events. Today's cartoon in the PI, for example, shows a ripped poster of Saddam Hussein on the ground and a smiling Iraqi standing on top of it, his fists raised high in the air. Horsey's simple caption reads, "A chance, at least, to be free." Terry talked with David Horsey earlier this week.
David Horsey, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your Pulitzer.
Thank you very much, Terry.
I'd like to start by asking you to read a few of your Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoons. Let's start with one that's based on an Aesop fable.
All right. This is a cartoon that it's multi-panel, and it is the fable of the ant and grasshopper, which, at least in the old days, was familiar to everyone. In the first panel, there's this ant in his bow tie and white shirt sitting in his cubicle at work, and the caption says, "In the spring, the sensible, industrious ant put all of his savings into a 401k plan." Then the next panel shows the grasshopper with some bug friend of his at a beach somewhere, a tropical scene, and with some pretty voluptuous girl bugs walking by, and says, "Meanwhile, the fun-loving but irresponsible grasshopper spent his money on parties, fast cars, and trips to exotic locales." And the grasshopper is eyeing this young female bug in her bikini and saying, "Dude, check out the thorax on her." Anyway, then we go to the next panel, and the ant is receiving a postcard from the grasshopper. "Ant toiled on, and his 401k got bigger and bigger. When the grasshopper sent him postcards from his travels, the ant thought to himself, 'Grasshopper is so foolish. He'll have nothing stored up when winter comes.' Well, when winter did come, the NASDAQ sank, Wall Street tanked, and greedy corporate officers bailed out with millions, while loyal workers like the ant were left with empty retirement plans." So then we see the grasshopper and ant together looking at grasshopper's holiday pictures, and the ant's pretty dejected. In other words, the ant and the grasshopper were in pretty much the same fix, except the grasshopper had cool vacation pictures. The grasshopper says, "Oh, and here's a honeybee I hit on in Hyde Park. She told me to bug off."
That was great. How did you get the idea for making the story of diminishing funds in retirement plans, for turning that into a fable?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly how these connections come to me. I mean, it's why I'm a cartoonist, is because I do think that way. But it was personal experience, I guess. A few years ago, I was really upset that I was wasting all my money on trips to Europe, and other friends I knew were, you know, I'd invested in Microsoft and everything else, and they were doing great. And then suddenly, we were in the same place. I was the grasshopper. So for some reason, the old story just came to me, and I thought that was a perfect analogy.
I'm going to ask you to read another one from your Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoons. And this one is called Tax Cuts for the Wealthy.
Oh, yes. This one is pretty popular. Got reprinted in a lot of places, and it's a multi-panel one. I guess these work better on radio, don't they?
They work good on radio.
Yeah. The wordless ones would be a problem. So this is six panels, and it's the president at a press conference, and he's taking questions, and the first question in the first panel is, "Mr. President, what should be done with any budget surplus?" And he says, "Tax cuts for the wealthy." The next panel, next question, "Mr. President, what if the surplus is gone?" "Tax cuts for the wealthy," is the answer. "Mr. President, how do we stimulate the economy?" "Tax cuts for the wealthy." And another panel, "Mr. President, how can we deal with job losses?" "Tax cuts for the wealthy." And then the next question, "Mr. President, what if the fan belt goes out on my 95 Toyota?" "Tax cuts for the..." okay, who's the wise guy?
That's very good. Can you talk a little bit about coming up with that one?
Well, this is almost literal. Just observing the news for any, through the first year, actually continuing into all the years of the Bush administration, the answer to any economic situation seems to be tax cuts, and which, of course, go to the richest Americans. And it seemed a little goofy to me, to put it simply. And so I just had to figure out a venue to somehow get this across, that, you know, no matter what the situation is with the economy or the surplus or the lack of surplus or with jobs, there's one answer, to one size fits all.
Is it particularly difficult to come up with funny editorial cartoons about the economy? The economy could be a lot of facts and figures that are boring and hard to grasp and abstract.
Yeah, it is tough. In fact, it's very tough. And it seems like a few years ago, economic issues weren't as predominant in the news or in politics. And I shied away from them because they are tough. And a cartoon is trying to whittle down complex issues into a bite-sized chunk. But the more I've done it, and I think part of it is I depend on what my readers know. And as people have gotten more involved with the stock market, with 401ks, I think Americans in general are more attuned to economic issues. So that makes it easier because they've become real gut issues for a lot of people. So it's not as tough as it used to be.
Well, I want you to read some of the editorial cartoons that you've been doing about the war. Let's start with an early one from September 29th of 2002, and this one is called The Atlantic Alliance and Update. Would you describe it for us?
Yeah, it's a scene at a football game. We're down on the bench with the team, and yeah, The Atlantic Alliance and Update is what it is. And on the team, the quarterback is George Bush. We've got Blair, we've got Schroeder from Germany and Chirac from France. Over in the corner is Putin and the water boy. He has no lines, but everyone else does. And so the quarterback, Bush, saying, "What are we waiting for? Let's slam Saddam." And he's trying to get him out on the field. Blair is at his side pleading, saying, "Oh, jolly good. May I carry the ball just once? May I? May I?" And meanwhile, Schroeder likes it on the bench. He's got a member of the Green Party sitting on his lap, and he's saying, "I'm perfectly happy right here on the bench." And over in the corner, Chirac is drinking some wine and having lunch, and he's saying, "Must we? Perhaps if we take time for lunch, Iraq will simply forfeit the game."
And I wonder what kind of reaction you got to that one, and if people could even figure out which side you were on.
Well, it wasn't entirely clear here. This is a cartoon that's more descriptive, I think, than taking a hard stand one way or another.
Right.
For whatever reason, I've followed European politics and U.S. European politics for quite a while, and this is actually kind of an update of other cartoons I'd done on this subject. And I've always found that Americans don't pay enough attention to international affairs and our relations with Europe in particular. And so when I do deal with the subject, I try to I guess I make them more explanatory in a way, trying to fill it out, who these guys are and what their positions are. And just the contrast of attitudes is what I was trying to get at with this cartoon.
You know, when you're cartooning about war, cartoons are often funny. They're supposed to be funny. But, a part of war, even a part of a very short war, is death. And that's something that you've confronted in your editorial cartoons. And I'm going to ask you to read a very recent one from Wednesday, April 9th. And it's called The Cost of War. Would you describe it?
Yeah, this is unlike some of the other cartoons we've talked about. It's very simple. It has no words other than that caption, "The Cost of War." And it is, I actually looked at pictures of Michelangelo's Pieta for inspiration for this cartoon. On one side, I have a mother holding her dying son, an American soldier, and she's looking sadly across at a little Iraqi boy holding his dying mother, staring back at her, and both of them with looks of grief on their face. And I think with this one, too, it'd be very easy to do just no war for oil cartoon or something sort of simplistic. This, I was just trying to capture the tragedy of all of this for everybody on both sides.
How long did it take you to come up with this? Were there a lot of ideas or sketches that you did before crystallizing it in this particular frame?
This one I came to fairly quickly. The news story that inspired it more than any other was there was a story about American soldiers who had tried to stop a van filled with an Iraqi family, stop them at a checkpoint, and they failed to stop, and so they shot him. And then the reporter described the scene of a little boy sobbing on the sidewalk. His mother and father were dead, and the Marines were trying to help the members of the family who were still alive. And one of the American Marines just broke down crying because he was overcome by the awfulness of what they'd done. And I thought that captures what this war is more than anything I've read. And I wanted to somehow express that in a cartoon. And then I, for whatever reason, one of those connections that I can't quite explain, I thought of the Pieta, Michelangelo's sculpture of Mary and the dead Jesus. And I thought, okay, I want to show both sides of this, that there's tragedy on, there's enough tragedy to go around. And so that's how I came up with the image.
Do you feel your thoughts about the war changing at all as we're seeing more pictures of cheering Iraqis and Iraqis toppling Saddam Hussein statues?
I find my feelings change every day in a little way. I knew war was going to be awful. It always is, whatever it's for, whoever does it, wherever. My biggest concern prior to the beginning of the war was that this was going to lead the United States down a path we shouldn't go, a path of empire, a path that would make us an even bigger target and a more hated nation around the world. And that even if there's this benefit of providing the Iraqis with a chance for a better government, that it was a pretty big price to pay, and that there probably was a better way to go about it. That's maybe a little more complex analysis of the war than, you know, either pro or anti. And so I've tried to reflect that in my cartoons. It's nothing's utterly simple. And I've done day by day is to pick out pieces of this war. I've done cartoons that were critical of the Iraqi, what is essentially the Iraqi Gestapo. I got letters from readers on the left who thought, you know, I shouldn't waste my time, you know, stating the obvious that those are bad guys. And then I've got letters from people on the right who are angry at me for criticizing the president in wartime. And but I think the process I use, which is to really try to reflect a lot more than just sort of simple opinion over time in my cartoons, is what has worked for me. I think that's why I've won two Pulitzers and why I still have a job.
This was your second Pulitzer Prize. Your first was in 1999. And so that prize covered a lot of the impeachment era. So I imagine you did a lot of Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky kind of cartoons. And I'm thinking about how different the main story that you covered then compares to the main story that you're covering now, which is the war.
Yeah, it's an amazing contrast, which just echoes the amazing contrast for all of us between those days and these days. We've come a long way. But yeah, the 99 Pulitzer was for what I call the year of Monica. was sort of the height of the scandal, and actually was before impeachment really got into full swing. So that was a year when, you know, every cartoonist was obsessed with Clinton. And in fact, I remember there was a comment from someone on the Pulitzer Committee saying they were just sick of seeing all these cartoons about Clinton, but apparently they were less sick of mine. I also, that year, though, included some cartoons about a local scandal in Washington State, and they gave me credit for, you know, actually paying attention to some regional issues. So maybe that might have been what made me stand out from the crowd.
Is there a favorite impeachment era cartoon that you could describe for us?
One of my favorites that was in among the winning cartoons for the Pulitzer was Peter Pan scene. And this was right after the congressional elections of 98. You know, all summer, impeachment had been brewing. There had been all these revelations through Ken Starr about the seamy things going on in the White House. And under Newt Gingrich, the Republicans expected to have great gains. Instead, they actually lost seats in Congress. And so I again, was looking for a visual analogy to capture that. And so the picture was, first we had this crocodile, which represented the elections, and Newt Gingrich was Captain Hook, and he was about to fall into the jaws of the crocodile, and he was saying, "Curse you, Peter Pan!" And Peter Pan, of course, was Bill Clinton. He was flying circles around Newt, and he's saying, "Golly, maybe I don't have to ever grow up." And there was also the other little detail was that Tinkerbell, of course, was Monica.
Was it a difficult story to do cartoons about? Because it's, you know, it's a story that had a lot to do with sex, and there's limits where you can go with that in a newspaper.
Yeah, although there are lots of ways to get around the obvious, which is actually, I think, a good challenge. If I could draw absolutely anything I wanted, I would be too obvious and too lacking in subtlety. But yeah, especially contrast with the issues now. I guess what struck me about that period was that, you know, it was great fun, you know, it was great fodder for all the comedians in the country, and there it was easy in some ways to do cartoons, but they really didn't always amount to much. It didn't mean all that much. The whole thing seemed to be a charade on both sides, as opposed to now, when the issues cartoonists are dealing with, war and a dramatic challenge to the way the American government is run, and a whole shift in how America is acting in the world. Those are serious issues. I mean, especially since September 11th. And so even though what political cartoonists do is largely satire and humor is a tool we use, when things are serious, it's the best time for us, because what we our purpose is serious.
After September 11th, when the world changed for so many people, your job was to think of a cartoon for the next day.
Right.
So where did you go with that?
Well, my strong point is not the next day cartoon or the single big event cartoon. I kind of went where about 99% of the cartoonists in the country went. Everybody, the day after September 11th, drew one of two cartoons. You either drew the Statue of Liberty crying or covered in smoke or doing something, or you drew the Twin Towers in some form on fire. And I opted for the Twin Towers and made a comparison between December 7th, 1941, Day of Infamy, and September 11th. I was not real happy with the cartoon, and there were much better cartoons done that day. The cartoon from those days that I liked best was one I did about 2 days later after I'd had time to think about it. And I was actually looking at a map of the Middle East and noticed sort of the outline of the Mediterranean around North Africa and Lebanon and Syria. And if you look real hard, if you're a cartoonist, there's kind of an outline of the southern portion of the U.S. there. So I ended up drawing a map in which the United States was lodged perfectly up against Libya and Syria and this whole map of the Middle East. The caption was, "Welcome to the neighborhood." And I thought it caught the new reality that we were no longer far, far away from the troubles of the Middle East. We were no longer protected by oceans. We may as well be next door. So that was my take on the new reality.
What kind of art did you do before drawing editorial cartoons?
Almost, well.
Do I hear a nun coming up?
Yeah, virtually none. I mean, I started drawing when I was a little kid. My mom sat me down on a phone book. I'd sit on the phone book and with a stack of paper, and I'd draw with a pencil or crayons. And you know, I was 4 or 5 years old, and so I did kid drawings, which are basically cartoons. And then the very first editorial cartoon I ever drew was in seventh grade. Actually, it was a class project. And then I worked on my high school newspaper, and I worked on my college paper. And I did some other artwork, and for a little while I tried to be an art student, but I'm really not good at painting or sculpture or anything else. I've always described myself as a journalist who draws. And that's really how my mind works much more than, you know, I'm not, if I wasn't doing this, I wouldn't be painting or sketching life drawings. I'd be a reporter.
Now, I'm going to ask you about a cartoon that I haven't seen. I've only read about it because I think it's probably like the most controversial cartoon you've ever done. And it had to do with race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Do you know the one I'm talking about? There's an African American, a skinhead talking together. Mm-hmm. And
right.
Do you remember what they say to each other?
I don't remember the precise words, but it's a multi-panel cartoon. Yeah, the skinhead and I think it's sort of a black gangster rapper, and they're talking about how they've hated each other and they kind of describe why. But then they discover that there are things they have in common. There are things they share, then they say, and we've found that we both hate Japanese and Koreans or something like that.
So that's their bond, yeah.
Yeah, that's their bond, is hating somebody else. And actually, now thinking about it, I really like that cartoon. But at the time, it stirred up a lot of trouble. And part of it, the unfortunate part, and this is where sometimes I can get in trouble without meaning to, was, you know, in Seattle, we have a very large Asian population, a lot of immigrants. And in the Korean community, a lot of people who don't speak English all that well and certainly don't understand the ironic form of American editorial cartoons took it way too literally, as if I was saying that this is what people needed to do, that blacks and whites needed to just hate Asians and then everything would be okay. So there was a strong reaction. And then the state has a couple of minority affairs commissions, and they decided to make this a little crusade and complained to the newspaper. And in the middle of this whole little controversy, I suddenly realized it really wasn't about me or my cartoon. It was about people enjoying putting some pressure on a newspaper and trying to make him toe the line. In fact, the head of the African American Affairs Commission, or whatever it's called in the state, called me and said, "I love your cartoons, man." You know, this isn't about you. Don't worry. You know, I thought, well, sure feels like it's about me.
So, what was the outcome? Did you have to do a letter writing campaign back to all the people who had written you? Did you have a sit down
meeting?
Well,
actually,
the one thing I did, yeah.
In the newspaper, I wrote a column explaining the cartoon. I really didn't apologize, but I explained, and we ran that, and we ran a statement from the people who were objecting. And it all blew over. But the one thing I did do, because the folks I was concerned about weren't the official spokesman for anybody, it was those that immigrant community, the Korean community, where clearly people had been hurt, and you know, I didn't intend to pick on them, and so I wrote letters to there are a couple of Korean language dailies in Seattle, and so I wrote letters to them trying to explain what I was trying to say, and indeed apologized in a way to them, and that seemed to help a lot.
Do you think that political correctness has changed the kind of reactions that you get to cartoons?
Oh, definitely, and in some ways it's not all bad. Cartoonists used to get away with some pretty incredible stereotypes, and you don't see that very much anymore. We were forced to actually be a little more subtle and exact, but it's changed things because there are some folks who are just intent on misreading a cartoon if it involves their particular group, and so I try to make sure, you know, if I'm criticizing Jesse Jackson, for instance, that it's clearly Jesse Jackson. It's about Jesse Jackson and not anybody else. It's not about African-Americans. It's not about other African-American leaders. It's about this person and what he says. So it's just usually I take an extra step because I don't want people mad at me just for general reasons because they've got a cause that they want to forward by getting mad, and I don't want people mad at me inadvertently, like these Korean immigrants, people I didn't mean to make mad. I want to make mad the people I mean to make mad. So I most of the time I try to think through the cartoon, because cartoons are, even though the simplicity actually makes them ambiguous in a way, they're symbolic things that people can read in different things to symbolic images, things that are not intended by the cartoonist. So, you know, when I'm doing it, I try to think, okay, is there anything here that can be read a whole different way? And I've gotten pretty good at that. I don't get a whole lot of nasty letters about things I didn't mean to say anymore.
Are there any words or phrases or images that you feel you can't use anymore, that you used to use, that felt okay, but now it just seems inappropriate? You've gotten criticized, people have been offended, and you don't do it anymore.
Luckily, I'm a pretty sensitive guy, so I never did a whole lot of stereotypical stuff. Probably the one group of people that I deal with differently is Arabs. Like everybody else, 10, 15 years ago, every time I drew Arabs, they were Saudi Arabians. They were in, you know, the robes, and they had the sunglasses and goatees. And I got complaints about that, and I realized, well, that's exactly right. And it's right not because, just because of insensitivity, it's because it's inaccurate. The Arab world is pretty diverse, and if I'm drawing Iraqis, you know, most people dress like Westerners these days. And so I've shifted that. I mean, what that does is take away a little bit of shorthand from a cartoonist.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay. We should be a little more creative and find new ways to get across visually what we're trying to say.
When you draw President Bush in an editorial cartoon, what features are you bringing to the forefront? What's your approach to caricaturing him?
Well, first of all, my approach to caricaturing anyone is, there are two aspects to a caricature. One is the physical look. You want to pick out those things that are distinctive about a person's face that make them who they are. And through the magic of caricature, if you exaggerate those elements, whether it's a nose or ears or eyes or whatever, if you exaggerate those things and really distort the face, it still looks like them. That's what a caricature is. With Bush, it's probably his eyes more than anything, those beady little eyes that are kind of close set together. I concentrate on those, sort of the sharp nose, his mouth that has that sort of funny little crooked line. I've started playing down the ears. Everyone seems to draw his ears huge, and he does have kind of prominent ears, but really that's not the big thing with him. But the second part of caricature is not just the look. It's somehow capturing an attitude visually. And early on, I think my caricatures of Bush tended to be portraying him as this not really qualified, but basically benign goofball who wandered into the White House somehow. But I think that was wrong all along. The more I've observed him, more I've read about him and seen of him, I think he's not a dummy. He's a smart guy who has chosen to be ignorant about a lot of things. And he's tough, and he's a little mean. And so my caricature of him has gotten a little meaner. What's interesting is that it's so at odds with what many, many people in the country think about him that I get a lot of letters about it. People who believe he is one of the greatest presidents we've ever had and is doing monumental good things for the country and the world. And it's not a vision I share, so I'm a little at odds with some of my readers.
You know, we were talking earlier about the differences between doing editorial cartoons now in the war in Iraq era and doing them in 1999. In 1998, you won your first Pulitzer in 1999, and that was for your cartoons of the impeachment era. One thing that holds those two eras in common is how divided the country has been over those issues, over the war, over impeachment.
Oh, that's true. I mean, the split in this country is pretty remarkable, and was so obvious in the last presidential election where it was a perfect split. But yeah, the passions in the Clinton era were just as strong, but you know, they're sort of reversed. I mean, people who disliked Clinton disliked him with an amazing intensity. And, it's a similar intensity with among liberals these days regarding George W. Bush. And there is not a whole lot of middle ground, it seems, for most people.
Have you been able to directly address in any cartoons how divided the country is over certain issues?
Well, I think I've done that a lot. In fact, one of the cartoons I entered in the Pulitzer competition this last year that was among the winners was an extended cartoon I did that was actually a full page in the newspaper in color, and it was a guide to red and blue America. And it was just a number of panels.
And this is the red and the blue of the voting map of how the different states
the red
divided during
the
2000
election. The blue being the East and West Coast and the Gore voters, and red being the heartland and more conservative voters. So this is sort of my sociological view of that divide. And for instance, I had one was sports in kids' sports in red America, and there was these kids in red uniforms rushing onto the field and on the football field, and the coach is saying, kill, kill, kill. And in blue America, it was a mom coaching girls' soccer, and the goalie is crying because one of the other girls has just scored, and the mom is saying, well, maybe we should give Wendy a point, too, because we have to affirm her part in this. Yeah. And another panel, or two panels, was a blue vacation, red vacation. Blue was eco-touring, and had a woman in the water kissing a dolphin. And the other one, in red America, it was a guy on the back of a snowmobile shooting sheep. I'm not, shooting deer. I had some snowmobilers who didn't like that one. And the final one, panel, if I remember it right, was someone in Blue America going to sleep blissfully, knowing that 1,000 miles away a national forest was being protected. And in Red America, a guy was laying there awake and angry because a national forest 5 miles away was being protected. So anyway, I had a lot of fun with the issue in that extended form.
Do you think of yourself as fitting into Red or Blue America?
Well, I'm pretty blue. I mean, I do live in Seattle, after all. And I'm very pro-environment, and I hate getting labeled, though. I've always tried to avoid it, but I guess if you looked at my cartoons a lot, you'd have to say I tend to be on the blue side. But because I don't want to be predictable, and because I think there are lunatics and fools on all sides, I try to step away from it once in a while when it's justified, and take a shot at my own side.
And finally, I have to ask you about your signature, and the signature is so important for an editorial cartoonist.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have this kind of scrawl, and you can't really read what their name is, but you have this very clearly lettered signature, Horsey, H-O-R-S-E-Y. Can't confuse that with anything else.
That's right. Well, I don't know. I guess I'm just a straightforward guy. I've used that signature. It hasn't changed much for a couple of decades. And yeah, I'm always surprised when a cartoonist sort of scribbles something in the corner that no one can read. I want credit. I want people to know this is mine. And please give me a Pulitzer.
Yeah, well, congratulations on the credit you just got, which is the Pulitzer, your second. And David Horsey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was great.